to the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast. Hi, this is Shane Vanderhart. Happy Friday. Welcome back to another episode. Today I want to talk about a couple things. First, President Trump's threat to increase the tariff on Mexican products if the illegal immigration problem is not solved. Then I want to get into Mueller's statement, Robert Mueller's first and final, supposedly, statement, public statement on his investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election, as well as his report. Then I had a conversation with Walt Rogers, former state representative Walt Rogers, who is now the deputy director of Tax Education Foundation. So we talk about TEF Iowa, what they do, what he plans to do, what his vision is. Before we get to all that, first a word from our sponsor, American Principles Project.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
And we're back. I first want to talk about President Trump's recent threat to raise a tariff 5% on Mexico by I believe it's June 10th, don't have that right in front of me, but I believe it's in a couple weeks, if they do not stem the tide of migrants coming through their country. First of all, I want to establish that I think everybody now agrees that we have a crisis on the border. President Obama's former Customs and Border Patrol director was on CNN, and he confirmed that fact. If I could pull up the audio here. Well, shoot. Here we go.
So I understand what you're saying. A number of these are Central American migrants coming through Mexico, but this is the president saying, Mexico, you need to do more as an intermediary here in the middle to stop them from crossing over into the United States. That's what he's asking for, and that's why he's threatening these tariffs. I will note, and you know these numbers, this week, just on Wednesday, CBP stopped a group of 1,000 migrants. That was the biggest group that they have apprehended thus far altogether. Many of them were families. So there is a problem, right? This is video of it that the president tweeted. So what would you do about it?
So this is a crisis, and for anyone on either side of the policy aisle that said it's not a crisis, these numbers are a crisis, and the workload is tremendous.
So that's interesting. He admits, hey, yeah, there is a crisis. Then we have this clip from CNN.
Program. So President Trump says his tariff threat is a result of what happened at the border. Border Patrol agents in El Paso captured what they say is the largest group of migrants ever encountered at the border city of El Paso. So CNN's Polo Sandoval is live there for us with the latest. What is the situation on the ground, Polo?
Allison, it was one of the busiest weeks for Border Patrol agents here in El Paso sector, as you mentioned. At least 1,000 people apprehended about 2 days ago. And as one DHS official telling our colleague Geneva Sands in Washington, that basically this is the largest group that border agents have encountered, particularly in recent years, since that Border Patrol has really been dealing with this issue here. I can tell you that these are the kind of numbers that, of course, President Trump has been pointing to in his ongoing claim that Mexico is just not doing enough to essentially stem the flow of undocumented families through their country and then eventually ending up here in the United States
program. So President Trump says his tariff.
Sorry about that. Started to replay. So basically, yeah, I mean, 1,000 migrants tried to come through the border and were apprehended by Border Patrol. That's a problem. I mean, that's a huge number. They haven't seen that number, well, like ever. That was a record. So there's definitely a crisis at the border. What to do about it? You know, President Trump, he basically, you know, he says he wants here's from his tweet. I got his tweet in front of me now from yesterday. On June 10th, the United States will impose a 5% tariff on all goods coming from our country coming into our country from Mexico until such time as illegal migrants coming through Mexico and into our country stop. Stop is all capitalized. The tariff will gradually increase until the illegal immigration problem is remedied, in the second tweet followed up, by at which time the tariffs will be removed. Details from the White House to follow. Senator Chuck Grassley, he responded to this announcement. He said, quote, trade policy and border security are separate issues. This is a misuse of presidential tariff authority and counter to congressional intent. Following through on this threat would seriously jeopardize passage of USMCA, which is basically going to replace NAFTA. Then he goes on, quote, a central campaign pledge of President Trump's and what could be a big victory for this country. President Trump should consider alternatives such as imposing a fee on the billions of dollars of remittance that annually leave the United States to Mexico, which only encourage illegal immigration and don't help the U.S. economy. It could fund border security measures and would put economic pressure on Mexico without imposing a financial burden on U.S. consumers or harming American jobs. He goes on, quote, I have long supported reforms to remittance law, which haven't become law because of opposition from big banks and other financial interests. Mexico must help get the border crisis under control, and the president should use appropriate authorities to apply pressure. I've also called for a safe third country agreement so that Mexico cannot simply pass the buck to the United States. Mexico has a leading role to play here when asylum seekers are traversing their country without regard to the law and without consequence. Congress must also immediately fully fund border security and interior enforcement. Democrats should come to the table in a reasonable way and work to put an end to the security and humanitarian crisis on the border. I support nearly every one of President Trump's immigration policies, but this is not one of them. I urge the president to consider other options. Then Governor Reynolds released a statement as well. She said, just pulling that up here. She said, we need to secure the border and address our nation's broken immigration system, but it cannot be done on the backs of Iowa farmers. Iowans are frustrated with Washington's inability to reform our country's immigration system and address the crisis at the border. But I'm asking the president to rethink this approach. Mexico is Iowa's top trading partner, and placing new tariffs could undo the progress made by the negotiated USMCA trade deal or trade agreement. Congress must move forward with ratification of USMCA, unquote. I agree. First of all, this is not a tariff on Mexico. This is a tariff on the American people because Mexico is not, they're not the ones that are going to, you know, they're not going to pay the tariff. That'll be passed on to American consumers. It's going to hurt American jobs. It's going to hurt American farmers. We've already seen here in Iowa, especially the impact that the tariff threat and the trade wars that President Trump's flirting with China have impacted, as well as Mexico and Canada before the USMCA deal, have impacted our economy. It's not good. I know he says trade wars are easy to win, but the fact is, the American peoples are the ones who suffer. Perhaps long term it can make an impact, and I think the threat of tariffs can maybe sometimes help to apply pressure. But we need to understand the impact it makes on our economy. And too, I agree with Senator Grassley, not President Grassley, that the tariff authority and border security, they're not connected. And to say we're going to ratchet up the tariff, have it increase until the illegal immigration problem is solved. Wow. That's, first of all, it Mexico definitely has a role to play. As Senator Grassley said,
they are allowing just migrants to come through their country because they know they're not going to end up in Mexico. They're going to come to our border. They could stem the tide at their southern border. They could do a better job of dealing with migrants that come into their country before they get to the United States. Just allowing, you know, them to pass through to the United States is not helpful for us. And it's certainly, you know, I think we do have some things, and I think the remittance change in, you know, in remittance and a fee, you know, things like that. Those are certainly things that should be talked about and should be considered. A tariff, while perhaps it might accomplish what President Trump seeks, you know, sets out to accomplish. I've heard some people say, good, you know, we need to take care of this problem. We have this border crisis. I'm tired of it. Maybe this will work. Well, you know, even if it does work, the ends don't always justify the means. I think this is an abuse of the tariff authority. I think Congress needs to take that back. That's supposed to be Congress's role in Article 1, but they've given so much leeway to the president. So I would like to see, you know, them take back and see better checks and balances and separation of power and see those things respected and have those things respected regardless of who resides in the White House, whether it's Republican or Democrat. It shouldn't matter. I want to shift gears here and talk about Robert Mueller's statement to the press this week. This was his first statement to the press. He was quiet ever since being appointed special counsel to investigate Russian interference into the 2016 presidential election. And he, you know, mum was the word. He didn't make any statements. He didn't release. There was some information leaked, but I have no idea whether that was encouraged by him or not. So ironically, this was his first statement, but it was also probably his last because they're shuttering the special counsel office, as well as he's resigning and into public, you know, to go to back to private life. So he's leaving the Department of Justice, and that was kind of his final statement, and ironically his first. So he said a number of different things during his statement, I think, are worthy to discuss. First, he goes into outlining the indictments involving the Russians who allegedly interfered with our election.
As alleged by the grand jury in an indictment, Russian intelligence officers who were part of the Russian military launched a concerted attack on our political system. The indictment alleges that they used sophisticated cyber techniques to hack into computers and networks used by the Clinton campaign. They stole private information and then released that information through fake online and identities and through the organization WikiLeaks. The releases were designed and timed to interfere with our election and to damage a presidential candidate. And at the same time, as the grand jury alleged in a separate indictment, a private Russian entity engaged in a social media operation where Russian citizens posed as Americans in order to influence an election. These indictments contain allegations, and we are not commenting on the guilt or the innocence of any specific defendant. Every defendant is presumed innocent unless and until proven guilty. As alleged.
So, you know, basically, his last statement, you know, totally agree. Anybody indicted has the presumption of innocence until proven guilty or if proven guilty. So, you know, that was important for him to note. However, I don't feel like that standard has been applied to President Trump. Want to he talks a little bit about the obstruction investigation, so I want to play that clip.
The order appointing me special counsel authorized us to investigate actions that could obstruct the investigation. And we conducted that investigation, and we kept the office of the acting attorney general apprised of the progress of our work. And as set forth in the report after that investigation if we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. We did not, however, make a determination as to whether the president did commit a crime. The introduction to the volume 2 of our report explains that decision. It explains that under long-standing department policy, a president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he is in office. That is unconstitutional. Even if the charge is kept under seal and hidden from public view, that too is prohibited. The special counsel's office is part of the Department of Justice, and by regulation, it was bound by that department policy. Charging the president with a crime was therefore not an option we could consider. The department's written opinion explaining the policy makes several important points that further informed our handling of the obstruction investigation. Those points are summarized in our report, and I will describe two of them for you. First, the opinion explicitly permits the investigation of a sitting president because it is important to preserve evidence while memories are fresh and documents available. Among other things, that evidence could be used if there were co-conspirators who could be charged now. And second, the opinion says that the Constitution requires a process other than the criminal justice system to formally accuse a sitting president of wrongdoing. And beyond department policy, we were guided by principles of fairness. It would be unfair to potentially accuse somebody of a crime when there can be no court resolution of the actual charge. So that was Justice Department policy. Those were the principles under which we operated. And from them, we concluded that we would not reach a determination one way or the other about whether the president committed a crime. That is the office's final position, and we will not comment on any other conclusions or hypotheticals about the president.
So basically, he said we're not. If he didn't commit a crime, we would have said so. We can't conclude he committed a crime either. I have a real problem with the statement. First of all, he said also it wouldn't be fair to indict somebody if we're not going to basically, take it to court. But yet he, in his report, he laid out all this stuff. A lot of it, frankly, is opinion. In a report, it's 200 pages, and this is information if he was going to indict would have been brought before a federal grand jury and sealed until an indictment came down. But yet now all this is in, public. So basically I want to just cover a couple things. He mentioned that, the order appointing him as special counsel gave him, definitely some broad authorities. Basically, it authorized him to conduct the investigation into that was launched by then FBI Director James B. Comey, or that was confirmed by then FBI Director James Comey in testimony before the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence in 2017. That includes any links and or coordination between the Russian government and individuals associated with the campaign of President Donald Trump and any matters that arose or may arise directly from the investigation and any other matters within the scope of 28 CFR 600.4A, which is basically the federal statutes concerning special counsels that original jurisdiction. It says the jurisdiction of a special counsel shall also include the authority to investigate and prosecute federal crimes committed in the course of and with intent to interfere with the special counsel's investigation, such as perjury, obstruction of justice, destruction of evidence, and intimidation of witnesses, and to conduct appeals arising out of the matter being investigated and or prosecuted. So You know, just some, I want to highlight a couple things. The part two of the Mueller report was not a good look for the president. Here's one thing that he said in the executive summary. He said, while it may be more difficult to establish that public-facing acts were motivated by corrupt intent, the president's power to influence actions, persons, and events is enhanced by his unique ability to attract attention through use of mass communications. And no principle of law excludes public acts from the scope of obstruction statutes. If the likely effect of the acts is to intimidate witnesses or alter their testimony, the justice system's integrity is equally threatened. Here he's talking primarily about President Trump's use of Twitter and, you know, it's Russia, it's a witch hunt, yada, yada. And, you know, basically President Trump was making a bunch of statements about the Russian investigation he should not have made. Most people, unless you're, you know, really, really on board with the Trump train, would agree with that, that these comments were not helpful to him, certainly, because, you know, we knew that that obstruction would have been part of what Special Counselor Mueller was investigating. Going on, second part, this is the president's efforts to influence the investigation were mostly unsuccessful. But that is largely because the persons who surrounded the president declined to carry out orders or accede to his requests. Former Director James Comey did not end the investigation of retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, which ultimately resulted in Flynn's prosecution and conviction for lying to the FBI. White House Counsel Don McGahn did not tell the acting attorney general that the special counsel must be removed, but was instead prepared to resign over the president's order. Former campaign manager Corey Lewandowski and Trump campaign official Rick Dearborn did not deliver the president's message to Sessions that he should confine the Russian investigation to future election meddling only, and McGahn refused to recede from his recollections about events surrounding the president's direction to have a special counsel removed, despite the president's multiple demands that he do so. Consistent with that pattern, the evidence we obtained would not support potential obstruction charges against the president's aides and associates beyond those already filed. So just three things that need to be established here under federal law in order to pursue an obstruction of justice charge. First, there needs to be an obstructive act. Second, some form of nexus between the obstructive act and an official proceeding. And then criminal or corrupt intent needs to be proven. So, you know, whether or not President Trump, all that fits the bill, I think that's debatable. I think some of what he did was certainly, you know, within his Article II powers. For instance, removing the special counsel, he could have appointed a new special counsel. We don't know. It would have been I think it would have been a horrible thing for him to do, and I'm glad if this truly happened. And again, this isn't, you know, we're hearing kind of one side of this. There's no defense rebuttal. We're hearing what the federal grand jury would hear if he was bringing this before a federal, you know, grand jury, which is totally one-sided. You know, we don't know if this actually really did occur or not. Certainly him, you know, if he truly did order McGahn to lie about his recollections, and if McGahn actually did that, that would be, you know, that certainly would be obstruction of justice. It didn't happen, though. It didn't happen. McGahn didn't do that. So basically, you know, there was some things he said that were, you know, awful, unethical, certainly, if true, if it did happen. But I don't think necessarily it would fit the criteria of obstruction, my opinion. Want to move on here. He discusses Attorney General Barr's release of the report.
In time, I requested that certain portions of the report be released. The Attorney General preferred to make the entire report public all at once, and we appreciate that the Attorney General made the report largely public, and I certainly do not question the Attorney General's good faith in that decision.
Certainly a far cry from what you're hearing Democrats say. They're lambasting Barr. Certainly there was a disagreement over Barr's summary, according to a letter sent that was leaked from Mueller. But again, it was a four-page summary. And then Barr later, just like 2 weeks later, released the full report for everybody to read, with the exception of a few redactions. So, you know, I think it's important to note that, you know, he basically, you know, while he says I didn't recommend releasing the full report, I'm glad that Attorney General did, Barr did. I think it's important that we saw it all, because had just a few things been released in the report, that would have, you know, further fueled speculation. So it's good that we get it all. It's all out there, and I'm glad to see Mueller points out that Barr did that in good faith. So then let's see his comment about future public statements. I thought was interesting.
Now, I hope and expect this to be the only time that I will speak to you in this manner. I am making that decision myself. No one has told me whether I can or should testify or speak further about this matter. There has been discussion about an appearance before Congress. Any testimony from this office would not go beyond our report. It contains our findings and analysis and the reasons for the decisions we made. We chose those words carefully, and the work speaks for itself. And the report is my testimony. I would not provide information beyond that which is already public in any appearance before Congress.
Sorry about my phone going off during this. Fortunately, I'm not going to. We'll just let that stand in the recording here. But want to point out, basically saying my report is my testimony, and he's saying basically I'm not going to say anything beyond what the report says. So I think this will probably just shoot down any attempt Democrats will try to make to have him come testify. I mean, frankly, in most cases in these committee hearings anyway, it's usually the people they're not asking questions, they're bloviating and they're getting on their, you know, doing their stump speech and they're pontificating, and it really has little to do with getting testimony from the witnesses. So, you know, I think Democrats would probably, it'd be an opportunity for them to berate him. But it sounds like, you know, we're not going to learn anything new. We didn't learn anything new from this press conference, from the public statement. We won't learn anything new from his remarks, because, you know, whatever you think about Robert Mueller, he's a disciplined guy. He sticks to messages. If he says he's not going to share anything beyond the scope of the report, I believe him. I don't think he's going to. Then he closed his statement with, I think, the thing that has been totally lost in this whole, all of the news, all of the reporting, all of the attention on the Russia investigation.
And I will close by reiterating the central allegation of our indictments, that there were multiple systematic efforts to interfere in our election. And that allegation deserves the attention of every American.
And I agree. It is important to know. I think we needed to know what the Russians did specifically to try to interfere with our elections. And unfortunately, the focus has been on Trump when the focus should have been on what can we do to prevent this from happening. So, you know, I would like Congress to address that, how we could better protect the integrity of our elections, rather than on how we can, you know, take political pot shots at President Trump. the Constitution. Now, he didn't write out, he didn't go right out and say impeachment when he was talking about the other process that the Congress has to determine whether or not the president is guilty of wrongdoing. He didn't go out and say impeachment, but that's what he was referring to. Basically, Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution says the president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. You know, that's very broad. High crimes and misdemeanors, what does that include? Well, I was kind of curious, going back, looking at the first of two presidents who have ever been impeached, Andrew Johnson, who succeeded Abraham Lincoln after he was assassinated. They impeached him. He wasn't convicted. It was a very razor-thin vote. He almost was booted out of office. But I read through, reading through the articles of impeachment for him, I have to say, basically they're describing typical politics today. Here's Article 1. Quote, that said, Andrew Johnson, President of the United States, on the 21st day of February in the year of our Lord, 1868, at Washington in the District of Columbia, unmindful of the high duties of his office, oath of office, and of the requirement of the Constitution that he should take care that the laws be faithfully executed, did unlawfully and in violation of the Constitution and laws of the United States issue an order in writing for the removal of Edwin Stanton, M. Stanton, from the office of Secretary for the Department of War, said Edwin M. Stanton, having been therefore only appointed and commissioned by and with the advice of and consent of the Senate of the United States, as such secretary, and said Andrew Johnson, President of the United States, on the 12th day of August, in the year of our Lord, 1867, and during the recess of said Senate, having suspended by his order Edwin M. Stanton from said office, and within 20 days after the first day of the next meeting of said Senate, that is to say, on the 12th day of December, in the year last aforesaid, having reported to said Senate that such suspension, with the evidence and reasons for his action in the case and name of the person designated to perform the duties of such office temporarily until the next meeting of the Senate, and said Senate thereafterward on the 13th day of January in the year of our Lord, 1868, having duly considered the evidence and reasons reported by said Andrew Johnson for said suspension, and having refused to concur in said suspension, whereby and by force of the provisions of the act titled an act regulating the tenure of certain civil offices passed March 2nd, 1867, said Edwin M. Stanton did forthwith resume the functions of his office, whereof said Andrew Johnson had then and there due notice, and said Edwin Stanton, by reason of the premises on said 21st day of February, being lawfully entitled to hold said office of Secretary of the Department of War, which said order for the removal said Edwin M. Stanton is in substance as follows, and they just basically go on to say, basically the order was unlawfully issued with the intent then and there to violate an act entitled an act regulating the tenure of certain civil offices passed March 2nd, 1867, and with the further intent, contrary to the provisions of said act in violation thereof, and contrary to the provisions of the Constitution of the United States, and without advice and consent of the Senate of the United States, I'm just going to stop. Basically, he fired his Secretary of War. Had this law been taken to court, likely, I would say the Supreme Court probably would have found it unconstitutional, because there's nothing in the Constitution that says the president can't fire a member of his cabinet. He should be able to fire a member of his cabinet. He didn't. This is insane, because this happens all of the time. So this would not, this article of impeachment would not happen today. But because they said he violated the law, hence high crime, I suppose. So that's one article of impeachment. Another article of impeachment said, Andrew Johnson, President of the United States, unmindful of the high duties of his office and dignity proprieties thereof, and of harmony and courtesies which ought to exist and be maintained between the executive and legislative branches of the government of the United States, designing and intending to set aside the rightful authority and powers of Congress, did attempt to bring into disgrace, ridicule, hatred, contempt, and reproach the Congress of the United States and the several branches thereof, to impair and destroy the regard and respect of all good people of the United States for the Congress and legislative power thereof, which all officers of the government ought to inviolably to preserve and maintain, and to excite the odium and resentment of all good people of the United States against Congress and the laws by duly and constitutionally enacted, and in pursuance of said design and intent, openly and publicly, and before divers assemblages of the citizens of the United States convened in divers parts thereof, meet and receive said Andrew Johnson as Chief Magistrate of the United States, did on 18th day of August in the year of our Lord 1866, and on divers other days and times as well as before afterward, make and deliver with a loud voice certain intemperate, inflammatory, and scandalous harangues, and did therein utter loud threats and bitter menaces, as well as Congress amid the cries, jeers, laughters of the multitudes then assembled and within hearing, which are set forth in the several specifications herein written in substance and in effect, that is to say. He embarrassed Congress. That was another impeachment, impeachable offense. That was article impeachment. Frankly, that happens all the time now, regardless of, I mean, there's always been a tension when you got, especially when the Congress and the president are different, you know, the majority of Congress and the president are different political parties. You have this tension back and forth, and it's insane to read this. But that's to say, basically, folks, impeachment is a political act. The House can bring up articles of impeachment for, you know, anything that they find, you know, that they see fit within the Mueller report. I don't think they should. Especially since a lot of what was mentioned in the report didn't actually take place. I mean, yeah, because they didn't listen to President Trump, certainly. I mean, it's not good if it's true. I think they have to prove a case that this actually really did happen. But, you know, we're probably never going to know for certain. Everybody has an opinion. I don't think anybody's opinion is going to be changed. But, you know, certainly what Democrats can do, and I know what they're really wanting to do through impeachment hearings, is just pound the president over this over and over and over again. And certainly the Democratic presidential candidates are going to pound this over and over again in hopes that, like the hearings that took place with Hillary Clinton, that this is going to substantially damage his reelection chances and lose the election. I think it's imprudent to have an impeachment process take place when we have an election so close. President Clinton, when he was impeached, and by the way, he was impeached by something that was clearly a federal offense. He lied before, he committed perjury before a federal grand jury. Now, we can argue whether or not he should have had that appearance, whether or not that grand jury should have taken place, whether or not Monica Lewinsky affair should have even been a part of the whole process. I've been one to say I think it was politically not the best thing for Republicans to do. But the fact is, President Clinton did commit a crime, and in exchange for not being indicted after leaving office, he gave up his law license. So, I think it's a well-established fact that President Clinton did commit perjury. However, you know, that said, also another point to remember, it was during his second term, so he has already been reelected. There is no electoral accountability to be had. Therefore, you know, if I think it's impeachment is probably a better option, especially when we're looking at cases like this, where it's not like the president's being accused of treason or bribery or murdering somebody. You know, certainly if President Trump was accused and there was credible evidence that showed that he, you know, committed murder, for instance, yeah, by all means, impeach him and then let's indict the guy. But, you know, this, I think, there's enough gray area here that I think we should just let the electorate decide. And then I think we just need to eventually move past this. If the electorate decides to boot President Trump out of office, that's their prerogative. If they reelect him, then it's time to move on, folks. It's time to move on. I don't think an impeachment process, while the House certainly has the authority to do it, first of all, they're not going to get a conviction in the Senate. Not with any of this. Not with the evidence that's made available, because I think a lot of it is subjective. So it's just not going to happen. But I don't think the process is necessarily helpful either. Again, you know, we'll see. It seems like there are a lot of Democrats not necessarily wanting to pursue this, but we'll see what happens. I wouldn't be surprised if articles of impeachment are made, and I wouldn't be surprised if President Trump got impeached. I just politically don't think it's the wisest thing for Democrats to do. I think as Republicans found, there's going to be some backlash if they do that, especially right before the election. So we'll see what happens. Well, moving on, I had a conversation with Walt Rogers. He is the deputy director of the Tax Education Foundation, which is the 501c3 arm of related to Iowans for Tax Relief. He was a former state legislator, state representative for House District 60. He was the House Education Committee chair. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Walt Rogers. Walt Rogers, welcome to the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast.
Thanks for having me, Shane.
Very welcome. So you have a new job. You're now the deputy director, I believe it is, with the Tax Education Foundation of Iowa. Tell us a little bit. First of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Secondly, what is the Tax Education Foundation?
Tax Education Foundation is an organization that is a group that is promoting and advocating for solutions and policies that will, you know, improve our state. A lot of people who know my background know that I've always preached about smaller and smarter government, and so I've actually been able to convince our people that we need that tagline. So Tax Education Foundation, actually TEF Iowa, its tagline is going to be promoting smaller government and smarter solutions. So in the simplest sense, that's what we're trying to do.
Okay. Now, this is the C3 organization that's connected to Iowans for Tax Relief, correct?
Correct. It's connected with Iowans for Tax Relief, and it's our sister organization. So one of the things that the way I envision it is, and I'm going to say TEF, I've never been a big fan of acronyms, but especially coming out of the education chair, but I'm going to say TEF just because it's a little easier to say. But one of the things I envision about TEF Iowa is, you know, our goal is to continue to look at some of the issues that are out there, some of the problems that are out there with our culture and with government, and our job is to find solutions, find policies that will improve those things. And so through that, you know, and a lot of people call it a think tank. It's somewhat like a think tank.
And right.
So we'll be doing those types of things where then we can tell ITR, our sister organization, hey, these are some of the things that we want you guys to promote to the culture and to the legislators to maybe potentially get legislation that improves things. So,
right.
I'm really excited about this opportunity because coming out of the legislature, what I tell people is I feel like the legislature really is downstream from culture, and we mm-hmm. are just kind of, or legislators are really just kind of reacting to what culture wants, whereas with an advocacy group, with a think tank, with what TEF Iowa can be is something that is really influencing upstream, upstream of culture. And so,
mm-hmm.
like I said, think of us as a policy advocacy group, think tank that is helping people come up with solutions and ideas to improve our state in every way.
And educating Iowans about these you know different policy areas, correct? Because that's a big thing of what
for
I know.
Sure.
It's, that I mean, that's what you know. C4s can lobby, C3s can't. So you guys are going to be focused on the education aspect and developing policy ideas. So what's the first thing that you think that hey we're going to tackle? Any you know what's I guess what your first. Your first goal stepping into this job?
Well, my first goal at stepping into the job is I wanted to make sure that our structure and the issues in the structure that we're using is implemented in a way that is the best use of our organization, the people that we have, and we're doing the right thing. So one of the things I'm actually doing right now is going to a few conferences, looking around the country, to see some of the other organizations that are doing this and learning from them, making sure as I move forward with TEF that we're doing it in the most effective way that we can that helps educate Iowans and helps policy and lawmakers. So I'm kind of like just really analyzing the potential of what TEF could be. I think you're probably asking more policy, you know, what are some of the issues? And, of course,
right.
You know, reducing the size of government is going to be one of my big things. And when I left the legislature, I think one of the issues was that we were looking at in our party was simply, you know, tax incentives and tax breaks and that aspect of government and making sure that that's done in a way that is fair. And so we'll be looking at that. We'll be looking at appropriate regulation. You know, I think there's over-regulation in a lot of ways. We'll be looking at, you know, our whole Medicaid and Medicaid fraud. Is there potential mm-hmm. there to improve that situation? And so those are just some of the things that that come to mind right away when I think about the issues that we'll be tackling right away.
Okay. You know, one thing that I guess I've been frustrated by when I've seen, you know, just because you're talking about culture, it seems like our culture has shifted to where maybe they're not so interested in smaller government. You know, we have Republicans, for instance, suggested, and you got a front row seat to this, you know, being the House Education Chair, suggest a modest increase to the school supplemental school aid, or whatever it's called now. Basically, you know, you're increasing yep. K-12 funding, but people are complaining because you're not increasing it enough. And it's like we can't even have a discussion, it seems like, about cutting anything, let alone education. So how are we going to convince people that we need to make government smaller?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's a great question. And even as you look back over some of the you know, last years I was in the legislature, we did actually reduce the amount of you know, state employees at the, especially at the administration and regulation arena. You know, sometimes you can look at a definition of smaller government as just a way we're going to slow down its growth also. You know, because as our population of any state and the entity grows, government commensurately grows with that. So if we can think about growing government in a way that's more efficient, more appropriate, sure, we'd love to get a place where actually we're reducing the size because in my mind, there is so much bureaucracy, and anybody who spent time at the Capitol dealing with some of the budgets, dealing with some of the things that's going on, realizes that bureaucracy is it's really becoming burdensome within government, and it's a ball of momentum that is really hard to slow down. And so if we can even slow that down to a place where less appropriately grows government at the right size, I would feel good about that. But don't get me wrong, there are areas that could actually be smaller in many ways. You cite education. Right. Education is a perfect example. That's really the biggest organization in the state because it's the highest funded element of our government. Mm-hmm. And so we've got an education system that is using, close to $4 billion of state money plus federal dollars that are involved in that. And so
You have also local property tax revenue in addition to what the state provides, too.
Right, right. So there's billions of dollars involved in the state organization of public education. And so I'm always, even as a chair, my whole emphasis was to put more responsibility on local control, let local principals and teachers control things. I still believe we're too administratively top-heavy with our public education. And so I'd really like us to see, that's one of the things we'll be looking at is school funding and is the dollars appropriately going to teachers and to students versus, how much administrators have we increased over the last 20 years in the state of Iowa versus the amount of teachers compared to students. So those are things we'll also be looking at. One of the things I found out just being in education in the chair is it's the hardest part of government to understand how the funding works. And so I'd really like to see a better way of streamlining how the average person can look at our funding and see how it's funded per people wise. And so that's a big task. There's a lot of funnels of money going in education from different places. And to get it streamlined to be understandable is a big task.
Yeah, definitely. School finance is a mess and difficult to understand. And that's probably why I generally don't write about it. So it's just hard to wrap your mind around. One of the things, you're talking about different ways schools could be efficient. You mentioned the how many administrators we have, but also, you've got support staff and people who are non-teaching roles. That I don't know what the current ratio is, but I remember seeing it. It's just insane the number of staff compared to students we've got compared to teachers. And I think we reduce some of those non-teaching roles, if possible, you could probably end up investing more money in the teachers, which we'd like to see more teachers and smaller classroom sizes and things like that. Now, I know we're getting kind of out of the realm of TEF, but it's certainly a way that right. You could probably shrink government.
Yeah, you entered into a whole discussion that is worthwhile. But what you're really talking about is the increase of paraeducators that we've had over the last many years, and a lot of those paraeducators are doing some great work. Do we have the appropriate amount? Quite frankly, teachers are doing things today that they weren't doing 20, 30
right.
years ago. And because of lack of parenting sometimes happening in homes, teachers are doing things that are just taking care of these kids on a day-to-day basis. And we need that, but we also just got to do it appropriately in a way that is best for the kid and best for the dollars that are being spent.
Right. So another thing that's frustrated me, Walt, I'm sure it's probably frustrated you, is that we have in Iowa this system of picking winners and losers when it comes to tax breaks, tax credits, things like that. How can we best level the playing field for businesses in Iowa?
Right. And that's what I said before. Tax breaks and tax credits. It's an issue that we'll be looking at. It's one of those things that very hard because you want a level playing field, but yet you also want autonomy in every entity to be able to do what they want to do to attract people. And so it's either like, let's get rid of all tax credits, all tax breaks, so there's an even playing field, or we allow them in a way that's best use for each entity to attract people to the area. Local governments love the idea of TIF. You know what TIF is, tax increment financing.
Right.
And so they use that to attract people, but we've seen over the years that if people abuse that right and that idea of attracting people, then it becomes unfair. And so that's something we'll be looking at real close. Is there an unfair use of tax breaks and tax credits right now? It's definitely something coming out of the Republican caucus the last couple of years that they are concerned about too. Representative Grassley in the Appropriations Committee, we actually passed a bill that didn't get touched by the Democrats. So it's something that we'll be looking at, and we want to take an honest, fair approach to it and see what's best for tax incentives all across the state.
Okay. Any other areas of policy that you think you're going to touch on this first year of service with TEF?
I've got a whole list. I don't have it in front of me right now, but I think I've regulation is definitely one.
I was going to say, well, you haven't committed to memory yet. I mean, come on.
I don't. overregulation is something we'll be looking at. Obviously, we're very concerned about that. Our whole tax system, I think we've got to continue to look at our corporate tax rate. We want to continue to further go down the road of what we did with property taxes the past couple of years. I don't think we want to settle on our laurels with that. I think we're going to continue to promote the idea, and it's always been my idea, that dollar bills kept in the hands of entrepreneurs and job creators is going to be much better for our state, much better for our economy. So we're always going to be looking at our tax system at the corporate level, at the property tax level, and at the income tax level, and how we can improve that and make sure people are keeping more of their dollars in their pocket.
Great. Well, hey, where can people learn more about TEF?
Our website is tefiowa.org, tefiowa.org. My email is wrogers@tefiowa.org. And I'm working on switching over, trying to get a smarter website for that also. But okay. As of right now, tefiowa.org is the best place to reach us.
Great. Well, hey, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. And best of luck to you as you go forward. And I'm sure we'll be talking to you soon again.
Hey, thanks so much for the opportunity and blessings to you.
And that concludes today's episode of the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you happen to be listening to this podcast somewhere other than on our website, please make sure to check out caffeinatedthoughts.com. Again, that's Caffeinated Thoughts, CAFFEINATD, thoughts.com. You can just Google Caffeinated Thoughts and we'll show up at the top of your search screen. Also, be sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for emails. That way you don't miss a single update. If you happen to be, if you listen to our podcast, you would like to subscribe. We have a variety of different ways you can subscribe through Apple Podcasts or iTunes, through Google Play, through Stitcher, through Spotify, through SoundCloud. If there's a app that we're not on, drop me a line, Shane@caffeinatedthoughts.com, and we'll be happy to see if we can add that to our list of apps that you can find the podcast on. Anyway, hey, this is Shane Vanderhart. Thank you so much for taking time to listen. And until next time, my friends, take care.